Good morning, afternoon, or evening. Please delete as appropriate. Hello there, I'm Andy Notko, and this is Material Episode 456. And I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that if your passcode on your phone is 456, you desperately need to change it. That's really, really easy to guess. Flo is off this week. She will be back next week, which gives me another chance to go back and actually talk about a topic that I was going to start off with last week. Before I got kind of sidetracked with stuff with Gemini, I was up really, 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 really super self-punishingly late organizing my Google Photos library for some reason. I don't know how that happened. I was just sort of scrolling through and I saw things. Oh, I could move this here and I could put this into a certain album. And yeah, I was up until like 7 or 8 in the morning on this sort of thing. So like 10 out of 10 for being productive and getting at something that is tedious and I was never going to get around to anyway. Maybe 3 out of 10 for realizing that I'm no longer 20 years old and I do need more than like 3 hours worth of sleep a night. But I'm glad I did it because I almost never take that kind of approach to Google Photos. Like ever since the first generation of artificial intelligence features added the ability to just search for photos by content, it kind of stopped the need to really organize things into albums and to have an awareness of everything that you're putting into that library. And of course, every picture that I take with my phone automatically goes up there. So it really is a collection of absolutely everything, but I'm counting on artificial intelligence and algorithms to organize it for me or find the things that I want when I get it. I mean, really, the only real organization that I'd been doing with it was to have this one album that's called Hip Pocket. And it's just like, hey, I'm going to keep something in my hip pocket so I can get access to it really, really quickly. So if there's something that I might want to show somebody later on or a photo that I might want to edit, I'll just boom, toss it in there and I'm good. But yeah, as a result, it made it very, very easy for lots of things to disappear. And also for me to lose a lot of context. Even on the most basic level, you know, I work alone, I live alone. And so it's easy oftentimes to think, oh my God, I'm such a lonely person. I'm just wandering through this world adrift. But when you, now that I've spent a good amount of time going through at least the last like 6 or 7 years worth of photos, now I have something that will help me through those thoughts. It has a Me With Friends album. I don't know why the algorithm does not do that. So just give me a list of photos of just me with friends, not just me. I don't want to just look at my big face. So it's nice to have this album now of, oh, look, here's every time that I hung out with my friends pre and post COVID and a little bit pre. That was very, very useful. Also, I added a brand new album for photos that I'm going to have some fun editing in Lightroom and Photoshop later on. Like I often take photos and again, they disappear in the camera roll. And then later on, I look at it and think, hey, there might actually be something there. Oftentimes it's really stuff where I just took like a big, big mess of photos, like trips to New York, oftentimes photos of curtain calls after the Metropolitan Opera. Like all I'm doing is I'm just blasting away, hoping that I will get one image that's actually kind of good. And then because I'm often in New York on business and I've got things to do, I'll like sort of forget about these things. Now I need to basically remember that, hey, look, you've got some really great pictures there. Actually do something with them. You're not doing it just simply as an exercise to figure out how many pictures you can take on one charge of battery. You prove that very, very well. Now it's time to actually preserve memories. It's also super fun on that kind of topic to like re-edit something that I've even edited once like a long, long time ago before I had access to 2024's tools because 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I was shooting with like an iPhone 3GS, maybe terrible, terrible camera. But now I've got AI tools that can take those crummy low resolution pictures and actually like make them get rid of all that camera noise, add extra detail. I've got better versions of Photoshop that I can get a lot more of that detail and image contrast out of. Also, I'm smarter than I was 10 or 15 years ago. I can actually make these into good things. There's a lot of really marginal photos that I've got in this camera, in this photo library that I was, okay, well, I'm glad I have this. I mean, it's no good as an actual picture, but at least I have a memento of that thing that happened. Now I've actually got like good pictures of the thing that I might actually want to print out and frame. Like, especially, can I say, like my roller derby photos? These photos kind of like are the intersection of those two things I was talking about, where once again I'm just blasting away at this super, super fast moving action, hoping I will get something. So, and then you get home and it's like, oh, good. I've got like 1,000 pictures, and of which maybe 100 will be worth taking a look at, of which maybe 20 will be worth like actually processing and sharing. Also, I don't have a nice professional camera, like the sort of $3,000, $4,000 camera body that you would normally want to have with you if you're taking pictures of super fast moving action inside like a community, like ice hockey rink, like which is where like most of these like bouts actually happen, that don't have all the lights turned on even. Yeah. But now that it's like 10 years later, once again, pictures that are like, oh gosh, it's too bad this is a little bit blurry, or it's too bad there's so much camera noise, I can fix all of that. It's like going back in time with a better camera. And I would kind of have forgotten about these things had I not gone through everything directly. More than anything else, though, it did get me in sort of a contemplative mood, this experience. Also, I was really punchy because of lack of sleep, so maybe that's why I was in a contemplative mood. It really did get me thinking about what we're missing out on by letting all those algorithms find and organize and present these photos for us. Like, we don't see these little moments until Google Photos presents this theme album for us that's created for us, like just on its own. Like these, it surfaces these old photos we might have forgotten about, because even when I'm looking for something that I can actually remember, it's great that it can get that picture back from me saying, oh, give me pictures of my mom during Christmas. But the thing is, there are a lot of pictures I'm not going to necessarily remember about, that I can't like actually surface in my mind the keywords. Like all of these, there are these things that are highlights, but then there are all these pictures that preceded the big moment in front of the Christmas tree and followed the big moment in front of the Christmas tree. Like, it got me thinking that, like, here's the analogy. Like, a building, it's made out of bricks, but also mortar, okay? And the photos of the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center, those are the bricks. The mortar is the photos of where I parked. I just want to remember what level of the garage I parked in. Like screenshots of stuff that I was reading on the train ride over, like maybe something I saw in a store, like while I was walking through New York, that, hey, I don't want to buy this bag right now, but maybe sometime in 2 or 3 years from now, I want to get that. Doesn't that look nice? That's the stuff that's just as important, like in total, as, again, the picture in front of the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree, the pictures of your friends and your relatives. It's not just Google Photos that you can't really access very, very well directly with your memory. Your actual memory is very, very associative. And so it's these tiny, tiny little details that surface other details, stuff that you would never have been able to access otherwise. And all these things combine to make the total memory. And they also reminded me of the other thing that I was missing out on, which was a true sense of the passage of time. Going through all of these photos one by one, just scroll, starting with like the picture I took of the moon or whatever just last night, all the way to, I think I stopped it, or I just got too exhausted at like 2017 or something. Day after day, picture after picture, omitting nothing. It really is like watching my life as a time-lapse video, okay? It's a potent experience. Like, my story felt kind of coherent in a way that it doesn't otherwise. You know, I don't know if that makes any sense, but like, you're too busy living your life to kind of look at it objectively. like not as a sense of not out of a sense of entertainment, but just what is the continuity that connects day after day, week after week, year after year, all of the interactions you have with the world around you and the people around you. It really did give me a sense of perspective. It was a very I'm pleased to say it was a happy experience. It wasn't like Scrooge being visited by the ghost of Christmas yet to come, filled with like fear and regret. It was actually quite pleasant, and I'm definitely going to keep on going through this. I'm going to have to keep on going backwards. Now I'm eventually going to hit like that brick wall, that moment where before when I really committed to Google Photos as my central repository of like backups of all my photos. I think what I'm going to have to do is what preceded that was Flickr. And I still pay for Flickr every month. I probably shouldn't because the stuff, what I used Flickr for before, I now use Google Photos for, but it does have old pictures. And it does have some of the dumps I did of like, here's old camera images, here's old like scans of printed photos. I need to add that to the corpus, so to speak. And not that I'm thinking of it, the other part of it is that if you saw Hamilton, you know that one of the most, the musical, one of the most potent parts of that story was the idea of like who tells your story, you know? And even if you do have a big family around you, even if you surrounded yourself with witnesses day by day, are you certain that they understand your story the way that you understand it? And of course, as somebody who, again, doesn't have kids, it's a more pertinent question. And it's not as though I want to, I think that my life is big enough or impressive enough that I want to make sure that his future historians have a firm grasp on who I was, what made me tick, so to speak. But it is an interesting thing. As part of my estate planning, I do have designated people who will have access to my Google account. If you don't have that arranged, you should arrange that, because there's a lot of stuff, a lot of personal history, a lot of financial history, a lot of legal history that you absolutely need the executives of your estate to hold on to. But I do want certain people in my life to have access to my photos and stuff like that. And it's not as though I maintain my photo library with my heritage in mind, but it is something I do think about. And it kind of pleases me that people will be able to, who are interested, will be able to rewind through all of these individual moments. And also, because I made albums of here individual pictures I thought were important, here pictures of friends and family that I really, really treasured, they will get an idea of what I liked, what I appreciated about myself, what I appreciated about them. It also means that during the funeral, now that part of the funeral package is, hey, look, we'll have a big screen TV somewhere in the room where people can have a slideshow. They'll have some good, well taken pictures where I may be Photoshop things to my advantage. That also pleases me. One last bit of fun. When I was rewriting back, that also gave me the chance to re-encounter all of the Material Podcast anniversary cakes that I bought and decorated since the start of the show, since I think show number 100 in reverse order. That's a lot of cakes. It also reminded me that I still owe us a show number 450 cake, and I don't know if I should. The fact of the matter is I haven't had cake in a year, so I probably need myself a cake. Well, this is a solo show, but this is a show about Google. We're going to go on with it. It did turn out, as it happened, that the biggest Google news this week was much to do about Apple. We're going to keep it Google-focused, but bear that in mind. For one, Apple has realized that Google is useful as something other than a straw man for their arguments defending their policies. They also realized that maybe Google can deliver the AI features to the iPhone that Apple can't. Also, the Department of Justice has brought the antitrust hammer down on Apple. Poor Apple. They figure that, they were just sick and tired of their biggest competitor, Google, spending all that time in the antitrust spotlight. They want some of the glamour of the full force of the United States government wanting to break them up into subcomponents. really, really quite sad, really. And Google, it turns out, spins all the way through the 88-page Department of Justice complaint against Apple, just like cinnamon through a swirly breakfast roll. Also, speaking of Gemini, we've got some other news about Gemini. Don't worry, none of it is bad this week, I promise. Actually, also, on our member show, our special episode just for Relay.fm members, I'm going to tell you just how much a check written by a Google founder is worth. We did find that out in many instances this week, and it's kind of interesting. If you'd like to join in on that fun, hear this episode and all of the special content that Flo and I record every week just for Relay.fm members, as well as all the special content that's created by all the other shows on the Relay.fm network, really wonderful stuff, hop on over to relay.fm/material and become a member. Thank you very, very much for everybody who does that. Your extra cash is very, very much appreciated now and always. But that's for later. We'll start talking right after this break. Wow. I'm sorry. I'm not going to stop recording again. We're going to get into all of that after this break. Thank you very much for your forbearance. So yes, as you might have guessed from the tease, Apple is in preliminary talks, at least, with Google to license their Gemini AI model for use, well, I don't know where, but logically on the iPhone. This is the sort of thing that I both never would have guessed, and now that it's a news story, it really makes a lot of sense. This story comes via Mark Gurman of Bloomberg, and also a piece in the New York Times, both saying that the same kind of thin but dramatic story, which is that Apple is in preliminary talks with Google to license Gemini. Also, they're also talking to OpenAI, but I have to think that if they are going to license AI technology from anybody, it's going to be from Google. Number one, because Apple has always had a really good working relationship with Google. Whenever their interests intermesh, they do a good job working together. It's only when they are head to head that they, you know, become jerks for each other. Also, Apple is kind of desperate right now. They're in a very, very bad situation. Apple, 10 years ago, they bet on virtual reality as the next big thing. And also, for some ungodly reason, cars, which I still don't understand. Whereas, the same time, 10 years ago, Sundar Pichai was on stage at Google I.O. giving a keynote saying that Google was steering towards AI in the same way they'd steered towards mobile in the preceding decade. Like, if we do not make this pivot, that's going to be a bad... We're going to wish that we had 10 years from now. And, of course, that's... Google and Apple steal from each other all the time, but that was one idea that Apple should have stolen from Google pretty much outright, because right now Apple is really in hot water with investors. Now, of course, there are no danger of being out of business, but there's even though they're a $2 trillion company with about $180 billion in cash in the bank, there's a reason why they give like $70 billion in buybacks to investors, because they need to keep the stock market very, very happy. They need to keep analysts very, very happy, because it's the analysts who keep investors happy. And there are a lot of reasons for both those groups to be very unhappy with Apple right now. Sales in China, for instance, are tanking super hard. They're down 25%, and they're not getting better for reasons that I think I discussed last week. Also, Apple pretty much knew that they were going to be dealing with enormous antitrust problems this year, both in the U.S. And in the EU. So right now they're dealing with the Digital Markets Act that hammer came down last year, but now enforcement is in full force, and they're going to have to spend the entire year being super disruptive to their every way that they've been doing business for since the beginning of the iPhone era. So to try to keep the investors and analysts happy, they said, don't worry, we're going to have huge news about artificial intelligence, huge, immense news, the most wonderful, incredible news about AI. Not now, of course, but, you know, in the next few months. It reminded me of every single sitcom where, like, The boss comes in and says, "Oh well, gosh, I know you got that big meeting with the CEO next month, and just wanted to know like what you're working on." And then you know the whoever it is says, oh yes, gosh, here's the preliminary idea that it's a super sensational idea. And then the boss says, oh, you do know that like they specifically turned down like another proposal like that just last month. And now like the had to, oh no, that's not the real idea. We have the real idea that we're gonna be showing in a month from now. Oh my goodness, it's gonna blow your socks off. So put extra laces on your shoes to protect those socks from flying right off. And okay, wow, can't wait to see it. Like, oh yes, we can't wait to hear it, see it either. That's exactly the position that they're in right now. So now Google has to seem very much like a lifeline. So yeah, they're definitely talking to OpenAI for sure. But again, there's the previous relationship with Google. Also, OpenAI is really like so closely tied to Microsoft that I can't imagine OpenAI and Microsoft seeing that as a big advantage. I think that they want to keep that technology as exclusive to Microsoft as possible. Because remember that Microsoft isn't just that they aren't licensing OpenAI in Windows and other products. It's like they are actually just a major, major, major investor. And so they're so closely tied together that I don't know. But again, it's the relationship with Google, again, starting from the very first days of the iPhone, being having the YouTube app like actually like packed in with the phone. That was close relationship. The deal that they have with Google Search for years and years and years and years, again, that requires a very close relationship. It's been very rewarding for both of them. The Department of Justice would like to have a discussion with Apple about that in open court, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. And also, it wouldn't be just a good thing for Apple. Obviously, it would be a hugely good thing for Gemini. Google needs some good news to share with the public about Gemini. Having used both ChatGPT and Gemini and others for a few months now, I don't think that Gemini has more problems than any of the others. They just have a different set of problems. But that what they do have is a lot more bad press, a lot more stuff that can be spun into really, really super bad and super embarrassing headlines. So having like the biggest phone platform in the United States and one of the most attractive and prestigious tech companies certifying Google's work by saying, hey, this is good enough that we actually want this in our phone, that would be quite a necessary feather in their cap. And also be a big win for Gemini in general. Having even the tiniest Gemini model, not even Gemini Ultra, but having it just the model that runs locally on the device would give Gemini a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge that would actually improve the model as a whole. Now, obviously, if Apple were to license Gemini, it would be with a lot of custom guardrails. They would want to make sure they could stick to their promise to their users and to the world that, hey, look, we are a privacy-oriented company. We would not let allow any technology inside our phone that would expose personal data to third parties, because we're not like the other $2 trillion companies. We care about you. Again, that's subject to discussion. But for their purposes, they would say, "Oh yes, we don't worry. We've put guardrails in, just like with the Google search deal, using the Google search engine for most of the spotlight searches on device. They have Google gets access to a lot of information, but not like the same information they would get through a web-based Google search." Now, that said, it's hard to imagine that Apple would be interested in this as a long-term thing. Philosophically, they want total control over everything, okay? They don't want to be beholden to outside companies for anything. Like, they said goodbye to Intel. They made the huge step of saying, hey, we're not gonna have our product release cycles tied to Intel's ability to deliver a new generation of chips. We're going to totally upend all of our software, our entire operating system, to run on chips that we built ourselves at great expense and at great risk. Also, more cutting closer to the bone, they created a direct competitor to Google Maps, for God's sake, okay? One of the most serious and expensive and nitpicky undertakings there can possibly be to take the undisputed king of digital mapping and say, no, we're going to create our own solution. We're going to put cars out on the road to create our own maps. The most fiddly thing they could do. And yeah, it did. It was pretty embarrassing for the first couple of years, but that was okay because they had Google Maps to fall back on. And now Google Maps, it isn't as good as, Apple Maps isn't as good as Google Maps, but it's good enough that for maybe 80% of what people use a digital mapping for, which is simply how do I get from A to B, or and even like what does this neighborhood look like? A lot of that it can handle very, very well. And the basics, it handles perfectly well. So I definitely see Apple, if they were to do this sort of a deal, licensing Gemini, but then continuing to develop their own AI. Right now, they don't have any sort of capability like that at all. It's not like they haven't been doing any AI research. As a matter of fact, I think the same week, they released a research paper about a new large language model that they created in-house that didn't look like it was a LLM that was designed to actually deliver the sort of functions that they want to deliver on the iPhone. It looked like something that they built so that they could perform other bits of research for. It was like the research cadaver that they did the medical tests, the dissection on, so they could document stuff, I think. I don't know. But on top of everything else, they might actually probably don't even have the compute resources to build an LLM on the scale of Gemini. Certainly don't have the computing resources to operate a LLM that doesn't run on like local silicon. So yeah, they definitely need a number of years of breathing room so they can spin something up. But I do believe that in 5 years' time, whatever AI that they're using to deliver features to users, they're probably going to want to do that in-house. This has nothing to do with the Google search. This is another thing that I wanted to point out, that another reason why they would want to do this in-house eventually is that, like, there have been persistent rumors that Apple has been working on their own search engine. Occasionally, you would see some analysts or some researcher finding evidence of an Apple search spider bot, just like the Google search spider is indexing web pages. But why would they want to deploy that? Why would they want to compete with Google search when the Google search deal is making them like $18, $19, $20 billion a year? It's a profit maker. The reason why they would want to get rid of Google Maps is that Google Maps was not making them any money whatsoever. So this is a totally different thing. So there's, again, another reason why they would want to have that AI working for them internally. And finally, even if Apple does use Gemini, it's not as though iPhone users will see like the brand anywhere. It's not like Siri is going to be rebranded as Siri with Gemini, Siri powered by Gemini. No, Gemini would probably be part of a balanced breakfast, so to speak, of AI technologies that would power the iPhone's AI features. And Apple would probably, actually almost certainly, tune it specifically. Remember, that's not just the LLM, it's how it's tuned for a specific task. So whatever turns up on the iPhone would be probably a lot different than what turns up on Android phones, because it's going to have a different set of tasks, different set of privacy guardrails, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's interesting times, interesting piece of news, and also a good reminder that Apple's biggest allies are the people who the same companies that are smoking cigar in the same exclusive clubs that that Apple themselves are existing in. They want competition. They want an adversary. But right now, they want artificial intelligence, and they really do want a member of the club to provide that. So, and that solution would come from Google. Well, Apple hopefully got at least something out of those discussions with Google while they're meeting about Gemini. They could have peppered Google's people with questions about, hey, if hypothetically one were being sued by the Department of Justice, where's the best on-street parking near the courthouse? Because, yes, as has been rumored for a long, long time, the Department of Justice finally hit Apple with a 90-page complaint about all of their little antitrusty things they've been up to here and there. Almost not worth getting into. No, it's a big deal. I read through the entire thing just a couple hours ago. There's a lot of stuff in here that's very, very relevant to Google. If you're talking about how Apple competes in a market, they are competing with Google and occasionally partnering with Google. So yeah, their name comes up quite a bit. The overall message of this complaint is that Apple resorts to a whole bunch of tricks to make it super, super, super unattractive to switch from the iPhone to Android. And the Department of Justice is claiming that these tricks are anti-competitive. And they are alleging beyond that, that these anti-competitive actions don't just affect the iPhone market, just don't affect iPhone users who are locked into this platform, that they actually wind up affecting the entire market, or at least inside the United States. Remember that this is not, the Department of Justice doesn't care what happens outside the U.S. They only care about the U.S. And although Android is hands down the most popular mobile operating system worldwide, the iPhone has 70% of the phone market in the United States. So it's very, very relevant. So if they keep making the case that if Apple decides that a certain kind of app that runs well on a cheap Android phone will hurt iPhone sales, and then Apple, as a result, decided to ban it on the iPhone or make it really, really difficult, then there's a really good chance that companies won't want to make that kind of app for anybody because, again, 70% of iPhone users in the United States won't be able to use it. They cite a bunch of examples, but one of them is like cloud gaming, that if all a phone has to do to run a really, really good AAA level game that runs in the cloud, if all it needs is a decent screen and a really fast connection to the internet, then suddenly this $1,000, $1,200, $1,500 iPhone 15 Pro is not necessarily competitive with a $500, $400, even $300 Android phone. And so if they can stifle mobile gaming that way by making it a much more limited market in the United States, that means that even Android users will not get access to these games. And that's one of the reasons why the Department of Justice is bringing down this action. The Department of Justice is also puzzled why the United States smartphone market, the hardware, consists of just Apple and Samsung. Google is a distant third, despite being makers of the Android OS, they point out. They're also noting that, companies like LG and HTC and even Microsoft have dropped out of the phone market. Why has this happened? Could it be because Apple has done things to make it, to basically kill off competition? Who knows? And all of this, by the way, I'm not saying that I agree with these complaints and these arguments. I'm just saying I'm just reporting what they're actually making. So here's more details about how all this stuff relates to Google. They, of course, are mentioning Apple's control over carrier-based messaging through the Apple Messages app and iMessage by intentionally degrading the experience for messages that leave the iPhone ecosystem and come in from outside the iPhone ecosystem. We've discussed this a lot before, where if Messages is talking to any phone that is not an iPhone, you don't get secure messaging of any kind. The quality of videos and audio and pictures is well degraded. You don't get to edit messages. You don't get notifications that people have read a message or typing in messages. You don't get it borks a group chat, all this sort of stuff. It's another thing that's a bigger deal here than in the US. Internationally, you'll remember the EU has concluded that iMessage wasn't big enough to be considered a gatekeeper in the United States of America, with 70% of users on iPhones and 85% of kids using iPhones. Yeah, that is a big deal. The Department of Justice challenges that Apple, quote, affirmatively undermines the quality of rival smartphones, and they're deliberately making Android phones look cheaper and not as powerful and not as good. And that's backed up by a number of internal quotes, messaging at Apple discussing the situation and about them intentionally wanting to use iMessage as a weapon against Android. What about RCS messaging? Apple, probably to comply with regulations in China, announced last year that sometime this year the Messages app will support RCS, which would bring a level of secure messaging, much higher quality photos, much higher quality video, and a lot of that other stuff that we're missing out on. How does that clear things out? Well, obviously, this is a big win for Google because it seems likely the carriers will choose to have United States carriers will choose to have a Google-owned company handle all that RCS traffic. But the Department of Justice notes that Apple's announcement about RCS is, well, they're not necessarily buying it. The complaint says that Apple might just half-ass it and just to make sure that cross-platform messaging from the iPhone is still inferior. They also note that even if Apple Messages does choose to support the very latest and the very greatest version of RCS, and they commit to doing that forever and ever and ever, we pinky promise swear, Apple still is forbidding third-party apps from handling carrier-based messaging. So that would not satisfy their complaints. It would still be in violation of antitrust. What they're saying is that it's not enough. What they would have to do to satisfy the Department of Justice's complaints would be to allow me to switch to an entirely different messaging app to handle MMS traffic and RCS traffic and everything else. So essentially, if I wanted to use Google Messages as my default MMS and SMS apps and RCS app, I should be able to do that. It should not have like favored messages should not have a favored nation status. They also mentioned the Apple Watch. That the another tool for lock-in iPhone means that switching to Android would mean losing your Apple Watch. Yeah, they got another internal email to back this up. They also note that competitors to the Apple Watch, even if you have a fitness watch that costs as the same as the Apple Watch and has pretty much the same features, they'll because of Apple's limitations on access to certain APIs. Those third-party watches will only have very bare minimum functions. Like you can't reply to a message on even a $500 Garmin smartwatch. You can't take other actions that are available on an Apple Watch. You have second-class Bluetooth and carrier connections to devices. It's a degraded experience. That's a good point. I do note that both Samsung and Google don't necessarily want integration with Apple Health. They would want integration with their own health apps and services to bring more attention and bring more audience to that. But that's very, very true. My take has always been kind of ironic that I think that Apple should let anybody activate an Apple Watch without an iPhone, which would probably hurt the Wear OS market very, very badly. Apple has complained that Apple has, in response to the DOJ's challenges to in response to the DOJ's filing today, they had a couple of weak kind of defenses and with saying, "Oh well, gosh, we looked into supporting Apple Watch on Android. We spent 3 years on it. We ultimately decided that there are quote technical limitations that make that impossible." Whereas other reports essentially said that they killed the project because they thought that would make it easier for people to switch to Android. But my problem has always been, look, there's no reason why I should need to have an Android an iPhone just to activate this device. If I have a MacBook, if I have an iPad, if I have any other Apple device, I should be able to activate this. I'm to say nothing of just having an iCloud account. So I do think that this is something that they will definitely have to address. The DOJ also singles out Apple Wallet and access to NFC. Apple Pay gets special treatment. Also, you don't have third parties don't have access to NFC, which means that like a banking app, like why I can use Tap to Pay on my iPhone through my credit card issued through my bank, but I have to do that by linking that credit card to Apple Pay. The DOJ is saying, well, why not allow like my banking app to do that directly instead of having a middleman, instead of forcing Apple to pay 0.15 of a cent, I think, for every transaction, which adds up over time. I would take 0.15 cents out of every transaction that's done over on an iPhone. I'll take half of that. I'll underbid them for that. So yeah. Now all this stuff that we've been talking about is stuff that kind of makes Google looks good. If Apple were forced into a settlement that would open up the iPhone, it would be great things for Google Wallet, great things for Android Wear, great things for competitive apps for Android. At least one of this was not that good. Of course, they mentioned the Apple's deal with Google Search. They call out the what they think of as hypocrisy of Apple demonizing Google in public while making billions of dollars a year off of funneling user searches off on the iPhone through Google. Quote, Apple accepts massive payments from Google to set its search engine as the default in the Safari web browser, even though Apple recognizes that other search engines better protect user privacy, unquote. And I don't know how far that's going to go, because as Apple testified in the Epic lawsuit, and as was documented in discovery in that lawsuit, Apple legitimately just thinks that Google search is the best functioning search engine, and it's the one that users expect, it's the one that they want, and if they were given a choice, it's the one that they would choose anyway. But it could be bad for Google if there's a settlement that urges Apple to do all of that search stuff in-house. Apple will fight probably harder over this over almost anything else. They will not give up $20 billion in annual revenue very, very easily. It's more likely that users will be able to choose when they set up the phone, hey, what search engine do you want? Just as later on they could choose what browser they want to use, what the default browser is going to be, and they'll definitely choose Google. Speaking of browser engines, they also mentioned a lock on browser engines that you can have the Chrome browser on iOS, but it still has to use the Safari browser engine, still essentially the same renderer. Apple might have to give on this. Apple's already being forced to support alternative browser engines in the EU. That's kind of a lateral move. This is the EU action against Apple having to comply with the Digital Markets Act. This is another weakness in Apple's position. Because every single time they say, oh, we can't do this, oh, this is impossible, oh, this will degrade the experience, the Department of Justice can say, yeah, but you're doing this in the EU, and it seems to be working okay. The world has not come to an end. How are things different in the United States of America? So, yeah, overall, though, there are nods to the threat of Android throughout, and Apple taking action to make sure that Android is kind of nullified as a threat, at least in the United States, that competing devices are cheaper. They could do most of what an iPhone does. So the Department of Justice is charging that Apple puts up as many roadblocks as possible against switches, again, by excluding or undermining any sort of app or technology that would run on an iPhone, just as a $1,200 iPhone, just as well as it would on a $300 Motorola phone. I don't know how good this argument is. They do mention specifics. For instance, one thing that they are, here's a quote, in Apple's own words, it feared a world where all that matters, again, quoting from an Apple internal document, all that matters is who has the cheapest hardware. And here's the money quote. Consumers would, again, quoting Apple here, buy a expletive deleted Android for $25 at a garage sale and still have a solid cloud computing device that works just fine. Okay, that's a good point, and that's a really, really that's a good reason for a new Apple memo to circulate. Say, yeah, you know what? Why don't we? If you're going to say stuff like that, say it over the phone. Say it during a meeting. Don't put it in an email. Please don't put it in an email. Oi. So I'm not 100% convinced though that this is the reason why there's only Samsung and partially Google as real competitors. For one, there are other device makers out there. They don't have a large market share, but they're good alternatives. But I think that it's really Samsung that kind of killed off HTC and LG and the rest. They are a manufacturing juggernaut. It's not just the phones that they make either. It's the amount of marketing that they do. It's the power that Samsung has to get all these deals into the Verizon store and the AT&T store inside the United States. But as my feeling about this is the same as really every antitrust action, that I have no difficulty against $1 trillion tech companies that have operated largely unregulated to be forced to show up in a court of law and defend all of their actions and defend all their choices. Even if I don't necessarily think that any corrective action or relief or punishment is necessary, it's important that they stop relying on, oh, take our word for it, you users would not want this feature. Great. Explain that to a judge, to a judge who is not an investor in Apple, who is not an investor in Google. Do that. Speaking of relief, it's pretty much open-ended what the Department of Justice is asking for. A couple of things that relate to Google. They're asking the court to prevent Apple from using its control of app distribution to undermine cross-platform technologies, such as what they're calling super apps, again, apps that do... It could mean a lot of things. They're basically talking about an app that does like 100 tiny little things that can be done just as well on other platforms, cloud streaming apps and other sort of things. Also, preventing Apple from using its private APIs, again, the APIs that are only allowed to be used by actual Apple developers, excuse me, Apple employees and engineers and not third parties, prevent them from using those private APIs to undermine cross-platform technologies like messaging, smartwatches, and digital wallets, among others. So, yeah, so a lot of this could remove a lot of roadblocks or a lot of excuses and make it easier to be an Android user in an iPhone-loving country. Again, one of the primary reasons why I switched from the iPhone a long time ago was that I did fear being locked in, being so dependent on software and services that are only available on this device in my pocket, that even if I did encounter an Android phone that I really, really preferred, it would be super, super difficult to switch. It's so expensive and such a deficit in my time and my frustration that I would just not want to do that. Actually, that preceded my switching to iPhone. That's one of the reasons why switching from the iPhone was so easy. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how this results. Again, if nothing else, I want to hear Apple defend this. I'm going to take another break and another swig of water. After that, we're going to talk about Gemini. Let's end this episode by talking about Gemini. First off, Google has introduced a new restriction on Gemini. It will now restrict it from answering questions about major upcoming elections. This little bit of news came kind of late inside a blog post that they put up last week talking about the upcoming Indian general elections. Most of it was about all the safeguards that they have already put in place years ago to protect the integrity of elections, or at least prevent certain factions, whichever country that the election is operating, from at least abusing Google products and services too badly. But there's a new thing regarding AI. I'm going to quote here, quote, out of an abundance of caution on such an important topic, we have begun to roll out restrictions on the types of election-related queries for which Gemini will return responses. We take our responsibility for providing high-quality information for these types of queries seriously and are continuously working to improve our protections. Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. I certainly don't think that a lot of people are going to be using Gemini to ask questions about candidates' issues, where do I show up to vote, what are the voting rules. But yeah, if they do, right now the state of the art of artificial intelligence chatbots is don't rely on it for any specific piece of real information. Presumably, this also affects people who are trying to, generate a photo, a picture that looks like it was taken on an iPhone of this candidate that I don't like, just like winning a pie eating contest, and there's like blueberry pie all over their face and their chest, and they look real stupid. Maybe it's a good idea for them not to be able to return images and stuff like that. Somewhat related to that, though, they're already rolling that out for the Indian elections. They will be rolling it out for the elections in the U.S. a little bit later on. Not that it'll help a whole lot, but at least Google can say that its hands are a little bit clean. But actually, more than anything else, they will be able. This isn't performative. This isn't theater by any means, but it's just as important that Google be able to say, hey, look, we have these policies in place. We're not just waiting for disasters to happen. We're being proactive. Or in some cases with all these policies, after the disaster happened in 2016 or in 2020, we decided that perhaps we should actually board up that big hole in the wall that that weasels were screwing through. So this might be somewhat related. There is a brand new YouTube policy this week that requires all AI-generated content to be properly identified in YouTube videos. There were some questions amongst creators about how deep this would go. Like if I use AI tools to upscale content, for instance. Does that mean that I have to put a warning that, hey, look, this is AI-generated content? But as with most YouTube policies, it's not necessarily a preventative action so much as it is when they find someone who is abusing YouTube to spread disinformation or do harmful stuff, it becomes a pretext where, oh, it doesn't matter what the message was. The fact that you technically violated this policy means that we can take this video down, or we can take down your entire channel if we have to. So it's going to be useful for that sort of thing. I certainly hope that Google will have a lot more to say about protecting elections in the coming months, because it's the warfare has moved from sticks and clubs to guns and cannon, and now it's in the nuclear phase, and we need better protection right now. Finally, small bit of news: Gemini Pro 1.5 is the toppermost of the poppermost of what Gemini can do right now, what people can actually use it for, and it's now available without a wait list. Before, you used to have, you if you signed up for Gemini Pro, you would need to like make a case for, hey, I'm a developer, hey, I'm a researcher, hey, please let me in. And all of a sudden, very quietly, they just said, okay, no, everybody into the pool. So if you go to aistudio.google.com, you can see a very, very non-consumery interface for Gemini Pro 1.5. It's a more of a developer interface. It lets you choose what model you want to use, what parameters you want to use, give me a peek behind the scenes at how it's thinking and how it's operating. It's a scene, man. But as someone like me who's just using it just as an actual functional tool, the highlight and the big get from this is that you can your queries and your work with it can use up to 1 million tokens. And a token is kind of a unit, like a molecule of information, of data. So like if you give it like a if you give it a query of like two sentences might be like 20 or 30 tokens. The ability to have 1 million of these is really just change things. That's enough tokens you can now work with actual video. This is, you can actually play with some of the features that were in some of the demo videos when Gemini Pro was first kind of teased out a few months ago. So for instance, just as a way of messing around with it, I uploaded a 30-minute episode of a Hannah Gatsby documentary series that I found online. I think it aired in 2014, 2015. I hadn't actually watched it yet, so I didn't know what was in it yet. So I thought it'd be an interesting test to see, okay, I'm going to upload this, give it to Gemini Pro 1.5, and then ask it about what's in here. So uploaded the video, which was about 500 megabytes. After just a few minutes of processing, maybe 5 minutes, Gemini was able to answer questions about what was in there. Now, there was an early fail. I asked the most obvious thing. I asked it, hey, can you just give me a synopsis of this video? It appeared to respond, but the response was cut off partway in the first sentence. It did say, oh, well, this is the first episode of a Hannah Gatsby TV series about art, but I don't know what the rest of it was going to be, because again, the sentence was literally cut off in the middle, and it might have glommed that just from the file name. So I don't know about that. Now, I did know it was about, just from the title of the series, it was about nudity in art history. And by simply, I hadn't watched it, but I had like scrubbed through it in QuickTime Player or whatever while I was trying to figure out why I couldn't. Why something was screwing up with it. And I knew that, okay, somewhere in the middle of it, there was like a painting of like a medieval painting of Adam and Eve. So I asked, okay, does this contain artwork of Adam and Eve? And boy, did it come through. I found the thing that I knew about and much more. So the video contains artwork of Adam and Eve at the following timestamps: 24 seconds, Michelangelo's The Fall of Man, 1509 to 1511, 9 minutes, 21 seconds, Adam and Eve from the Escorial Beatus, circa 950, 955, 925, Adam and Eve from the Florence Baptistry, 1240 to 1300, 930, 1355, Adam and Eve by Albrecht Dürer, 1504. Another interesting one I'm quoting here: the video also contains a photograph by Bill Henson titled Untitled 1976 that shows a nude woman in a red armchair. This photograph is not of Adam and Eve, but it is a reference to the biblical story of the fall of man. It didn't seem like BS. I did go through and watch it later on, and that does seem to be comprehensive about all this stuff. Also, from the documentation, I don't believe that it yet has access to audio. So it wasn't able to process the audio and listen to description. So it was simply finding these images of artwork that were inside the video itself and breaking out all that stuff, which would be pretty impressive, I thought, particularly that last reference. They released a demo video from about a month ago in which they have a silent Buster Keaton movie that shows some queries like, hey, show me the scene where there's someone picks a character's a piece of paper with text on it is taken out of someone's pocket. What's the text on that pocket? It gives you the timestamp and also says, here's the deed, the plot device was. Here it is. They gave another one where after uploading that same Buster Keaton movie, did like sort of a rough sketch of like a water tank, like spewing out water, say, where does this scene occur, and found the scene in which Buster Keaton is underneath like a big, big, huge water cistern and gets blasted to the ground with this big blast of water. That was, by the way, the scene in which he broke his neck without knowing it. Didn't know it until like 8 years later when he went to a doctor and they said, oh, by the way, your neck has healed very nicely. So I don't know where, I never broke my neck. Oh yes, you did. Here's where it fused. Really, really interesting. I also gave it the PDF file of the Justice Department's antitrust complaint against Apple. I had already read it, but I tried to use Gemini 1.5 to extract what I would need from this week's podcast if I had not read it. It was mostly successful, but not nearly complete. This could be a failing in Gemini. It could have been my queries. I gave it queries like, hi, I am writing an episode of a podcast of the people who listen to this podcast are interested in news about Google. Please tell me everything about this Department of Justice complaint that is relevant to Android or Google or Google products and services. And it got a lot of it, gave me references when I asked for it, gave me quotes when I asked for it, but certainly not the understanding that I got by actually reading through the thing. I don't find that as a fault with Gemini. These are still, remember, very early days in AI. There are no winners yet. They're just different tools with different strengths. And as usual, you absolutely cannot count on any chatbot to do your homework for you. Well, I think that's going to do it for us this week. As always, once again, you can help support our show and everything on the Relay.fm network by becoming a member. So head on over to Relay.fm/material to sign up and gain access to special members-only episodes produced by all of Relay's contributors, including us. Well, thanks everybody so much for listening this time. Flo will be back next week. We hope you'll be with us again when that happens next week. Until then, please have a happy, safe, and healthy 7 days. Bye-bye.